technology. It's going to make our lives. It's going to change our lives completely. It's going to make them easier. It's going to make them brighter. It's going to make them work. But if your gadgets leave you giddy or your tech is causing you trouble, we have our expert from GadgetDetective.com, Fevzi Turkalp, is here to help. Very good morning to you. How are
morning,
you?
Morning, Nick.
You can call us now on 08085 909 693. Calls are free from mobiles and landlines. You can text us on 85058. Texts are charged at your standard message rate. If your email is working, and if it's not, you can get in touch with us those ways. If it's working, you can email us on upallnight.com. All one word, at bbc.co.uk. We're really keen to hear from you. Don't be afraid. Don't be ashamed. The number of times you'll hear some of Fevzi's advice and think, so that's what I've been doing wrong.
But you've given away my best advice already, of course.
Which is?
The turn it off and turn it back on again. I mean, so is early it, in the 2 hours and it's gone.
It's true, isn't it, though? It really does work.
You know, it is true that you know, most of our devices these days are computers, effectively, one way or another. They are computers. They may be dedicated to a single task, and like all computers, they can get their knickers in a twist, to use a technical term, and sometimes just switching it off and on again will help, and even waiting a few seconds before switching it back on. I mean, these are all trade secrets, but we give them away on this show.
I'm so pleased to be talking to you. I have sat at home through the nights listening and thinking, when can I work out a time when I'm presenting and you're here? Because I so want to talk to you. And a little earlier, you sent me a little list of some of the things that you want to talk about over the next couple of hours. And I'm so excited by a few of them. Really, really.
And yes, and one of them I chose before I knew I would be guesting on your show. So, yeah.
Really funny. We'll get to that later,
yeah,
though.
Okay.
Because we'll get straight on with the first messages that are coming to us on 85058. And we've got one from Nigel in Tenderton in Kent, who says, I have a very, very old, very slow desktop. I want to put 1,000 or more photographs onto an external drive. What's the best or the easiest way to do it? I'm not very techie. How do I do it?
Well, okay, so I'm just wondering how very old it is.
Yes.
I'm guessing it's a Windows machine. I'm guessing it's probably running Windows XP. So if that is the case, the first thing would be to say, don't put that machine online because, Microsoft haven't been upgrading it for some time, and therefore it may have a number of vulnerabilities that could mean that the machine and its contents could be hacked. However, if all you're looking to do is deal with it offline, I'm assuming it's a machine that's got some form of USB interface on it, the most ubiquitous little rectangular connector on the device, then it can be as simple as buying a cheap external device. If speed is not, of the essence, I wouldn't bother going for a solid state drive. I'd just go for a conventional hard drive, and one with enough capacity. And the thing is, it's not really worth going for much less than 500 gigabytes to 1 terabyte these days, because the drives don't actually get much cheaper below that. So I'd look for a USB drive, preferably one that's got an external power supply, not one that's host powered, as they call it, where it's powered from the USB, because we don't know how solid that USB is. And then I would just literally seek, if they're already on the machine, I would seek to literally just copy them off, highlight them all, select them all, and copy them over. If you haven't got any bespoke backup software and it's just these sorts of files that you want to copy, then just drag them across and do that. Beyond that, you could look at putting various other pieces of software on there. But if it's literally just a case of making sure they're safe and perhaps putting them on another machine, what I would say is that if you are using, at some point those photos will go to another machine, and your machine will be conveyed to heaven, then you're going to have to run a full antivirus scan on the contents of that drive, because we don't know what the status of your old computer is. So basically copy them across, get an external USB hard drive, connect them, and it will just appear as an external drive, and even an old computer should allow you to do that without too many problems.
Hope that's okay for you, Nigel. Next one is almost slightly linked, talking about old software. This says, I want to run old Windows 98 software on a 64-bit Win 8.1 box. I've heard of VirtualBox, but I haven't tried it. Would it let me run Windows 98 inside a 64-bit Win 8.1? So this is what a quite new computer running very, very old software. Yeah. Inside, they call them sometimes sandboxes, don't they? The idea being that you run them in inside a safe, as it were, inside your own computer.
Yeah, exactly. It runs in as a virtual machine on that box, so it will be given resources, and it will think it's running its own operating system on its own computer. Absolutely, that this can be done. It's still done these days. When, for example, software developers want to make sure that their software runs on different platforms, they're not going to have a dozen different machines sitting around. So they'll just run, Windows XP, Windows 7, Windows 8, 8.1, whatever it is, running in a virtual machine. So yes, you can absolutely do that. By the way, for those that are interested, if you've got a Mac and you want to run Windows, you can run it in the way that Apple allow you to run it, but you can also run it in a virtual machine, and the software you'd use there would be something like Parallels. You can do it. It's a good way of doing things. It's a good way of, for example, if you've got some old legacy software, typically things like accounting software that you rely upon because it's got your accounts on it and has done for 20 years. The company may not even exist or that made that software. They certainly don't do any updates to it, but you still need to run it. How do you run it? Because it won't run on even on Windows 7. That's how you do it. You run it as a virtual machine. And it has the benefit of making it harder for any viruses and so forth to jump. They can do it, but it's very difficult for a virus to jump out of a virtual machine onto its host machine.
Lovely. That's a perfect solution, I think. It's not something that I've ever really done, really. I've never sort of like tried to run older operating systems of the same type within something. I mean, isn't it time sometimes just to try and find a more modern solution to that software problem? I know that there are sometimes printers and things like that sometimes have real problems trying to deal with more modern software. But yeah. Is it a danger? Should you be doing it, or should you be looking for the newer software?
Well, sometimes it does really become time to bite the bullet, but occasionally, well, more than occasionally, it's often a valid approach, at least as an interim measure. So you may have a machine that's died on you. You've been able to pull off the data file. You've got the original disk, but now you can't install it on your shiny Windows 10 machine. So there, you create a virtual machine running Windows 98, or preferably 98 SE, I would suggest, and you install it on there. And then, yes, maybe you have to sit and spend a month thinking how you're going to do the migration in an orderly fashion, but this gives you the opportunity to do that. Other people just say that, this software is never going to run on a modern operating system, and that's the only way I'm going to be able to do it. The other thing is, often you mentioned printers, it's often driver support. You may have a much cherished piece of hardware that just will never run on a modern operating system because the supplier of that hardware has long since stopped doing that. So I'll give you an example. People who work in recording studios often use things with an interface on it known as FireWire. Now, FireWire was going to be this great way of transferring information. In fact, it is, but it never really took off outside certain circles. And yet, people might have all sorts of audio interfaces or other interfaces that require a FireWire driver. Now, in the future, it may be that the likes of Apple and even Microsoft drop support for the FireWire driver, and the only way you're going to be able to run those old bits of equipment, the only solution you'll ever have because it's got a FireWire interface on it, is to run it in an older version of the operating system in a virtual machine.
Perfect. If anyone wants to see FireWire, they can come round to my garage and see the three or four drives that are sitting in there now, because the computer that I've got now doesn't have the blasted plug on the side. A recurring problem.
What about a Thunderbolt to FireWire?
I could try that, but I don't want those. My house is full of those white adapters that go from one bit of a computer to the other one, and I really don't need any more.
I guess the thing about that is if it's to attach a FireWire peripheral, it depends what the peripheral is. If it's a hard drive, then that obviously means that device is probably of an age and is not, you know, not greatly worth saving. However, if it is a high-end audio interface that costs many hundreds of pounds and still works perfectly well, except for the way it communicates, you know, that is a good fix. And the Lightning to FireWire to Thunderbolt adapter is a good way forward. But what I would say, that doesn't mean, if let's say you've got a Mac and it's got Thunderbolt on it, and you put Thunderbolt to Lightning adapter, Thunderbolt to FireWire adapter on it, the thing about that is, the computer will still need to have a FireWire driver for that to work. The fact that you can physically convert it into Thunderbolt doesn't mean it's going to work without the driver. So I think that there are many good reasons to have that, and also, it's not just old versions of Windows that you can run on. More modern version of Windows, you can run, as we've alluded to, you know, Windows 10 or 7 or 8 or 8.1 on a Mac. You can run Linux. You can run all sorts of. You can run Android, you know, in a box. You know, so it's great for developers, but it's also great if you want to experiment. Let's say you want to learn how to use Linux, and you've got an old machine that's too old to run a modern version of Windows. You want to run Linux operating system on it, but you know, you maybe just want to learn it in between doing other things on your main machine.
As the old adage goes, Thunderbolt to Lightning, very, very frightening. 2:17 the time. 08085 909 693 is the phone number. Richard in Newport has given us a ring. A very good morning to you. How are you?
I'm okay, and you?
Absolutely brilliant. Better for hearing you.
Professor.
Right, are you ready to go away with this? Give us your question, and Fabsy will be able to sort it out.
Right, the question arises because I'm talking about PC now, not Mac. Mac is easy. Copying or backing up or whatever, and keeping all the info that's in properties, creation date and what have you. Now, I get confused between ghosting, mirroring, and backup. What's the difference, and what is the result when you do each of those?
Right. Okay. Well, mirroring is where you make a bit copy of a drive or of a portion of the drive. And what I mean by that is that the data is made up of bytes that are in turn made up of bits, and each of those bits is mirrored. It makes a mirror image, a copy of each bit. So the drive is a perfect copy of it. It's a mirror image of the drive that you've copied. A backup can be a mirror image, but it can also be just copying across files into a different folder, into a different structure, so that the backup doesn't have to resemble identically the source of the backup.
And they won't have folders in the same tree.
Yes, they can do, but for example, it's quite common when you do a backup to compress and also you can have what are called incremental and differential backups. So these are ways of not having to, every time you do a backup, back up everything all over again, because if you're backing up a large amount of data, this doesn't really make a lot of sense if you're going to back up frequently to back it up every file all over again. So what these other types of backup allow you to do is back up only those files that have changed. So you've done a full backup today. Tomorrow, you only back up the files that have changed since yesterday. The day after, the files that have changed since the day after that. Then when you reinstate or restore your backup, you have to use all of those backups together from today, yesterday, and tomorrow. And that way, you can get back to where you were. But what it means is that your backup will then take potentially seconds instead of hours.
Does it restore the folders with the same creation date and so forth?
Yes, it should do, because there can be settings for that inside software, but typically it would make copies of those files as they were at that time. Bear in mind, if you're using backup software as opposed to You know, simply just copying across files manually, as I suggested to Nigel when he wanted to, you know, copy across his photos, then the backup file will not, it depends how you do it, but typically a backup file can be a big single file that acts as a bucket for all the other files. So it just contains within it the information to recreate those files, and that information will include, you know, its creation date, modification date, and so forth. So, you know, the devil is in the detail, but it's certainly possible to do backups whereby you retain all of that information. And that would also be, you know, important, for example, for photographs and so forth. You don't want certain metadata for the photographs.
Yeah, where, when, and...
Yeah, exactly. You don't want the location changed or the creation date changed or even the editing date changed. And it shouldn't need to be changed unless you start opening those files up individually. And if you have good backup software, you can also, even though you've backed up everything, you can also go in and pluck out an individual file that you need rather than having to reinstate a whole backup. So there's a lot. You know, there's a lot of different types of backups that you can do. But
and what is ghosting?
Ghosting, it's not a strict term, but I mean, it's again, you can refer just to these mirror images.
So what would you recommend if I've got to? I've got one in one situation. I've got a PC laptop which has been contaminated. The only thing I can do is factory reset to get rid of the virus. That's when I was on TalkTalk and during that period when they let all of the viruses through.
Mm-hmm.
So would I use Mirror to mirror the hard drive? Or would I use backup?
I would, in the first instance, I would do a mirror image of that drive. And then, you see, I'm a bit fastidious about backing up, having been caught out myself. So the first thing I do is I do a mirror image or a clone of that drive, which means that, you know, if all else fails, you could just reinstate that and start again and do whatever else you want to do. Then I would use... I'd use a third-party piece of software. I'd get something, for example, from Acronis, would be in, a good place to go. And then I would do a complete backup. Now, Acronis have got a version of their software, the True Image software, that allows you to do backups and then reinstating to dissimilar machines. So this is a very clever trick. If, let's say, you've got loads of applications that you need to get onto another machine and you don't have the original disks anymore, and maybe it's not possible to download that as applications anymore, Acronis have a technology, and it's very clever, and when it works beautifully. It allows you to back up everything and then reinstate it onto a completely different machine, different operating system, different architecture. And why that's clever is because normally that shouldn't and wouldn't work, because the drivers, the bits of software that are specific to that installation, won't work automatically on another machine. But this software can do that. But I mean, for everybody now, before anybody has a problem, because we will all one day suffer a drive that will go bad or will lose data by some other means, it's really important to think about what data we hold. Just do a thought experiment. How would I feel, and what would be the consequences if everything on that computer were to go?
I have to say that a few weeks ago, I control A and picked up all my photos.
Yes.
And I thought that they were the photos in the recently deleted photo album.
Oh.
And they weren't. They were the master copies. And as I pressed delete, and 38,000 photographs disappeared.
Yeah.
I've never, ever, A, been so scared, and B, been so grateful and thankful for cloud-based systems that actually back up your photographs. How many backups of your main data, your precious data, do you have?
The recommendation, I mean, I go a bit over the top, I must admit. But
Go on.
Oh, I've got them snuck all over the place, encrypted and hidden, you know. So, but the recommendation is that you should have at least one copy off-site. Now, that can be cloud-based, but some data is not really well suited to being stored on the cloud because we lose control over it. And so let's say if it's a copy of all my favorite podcasts, so it doesn't matter if I store that in the cloud. If, however, it is very personal photographs, I wouldn't personally put those in the cloud because I don't want them being subject to hacking. And we've seen high profile cases of that happening. I have to say my personal photos are not that interesting. I just wouldn't want to share them particularly. So you need an off-site backup that can be cloud or partly cloud, but it can also be as simple as doing a backup to an external drive and then taking it around to your mum's house or your brother's house or sister's house, whatever, just keeping it there. The important thing about that is to make sure that that backup is entirely and securely encrypted, so that if it were to be stolen, the data isn't stolen, only the drive. So you need to do that. The reason why you need that off-site backup is, if you imagine if your only backup is on that external hard drive sitting next to your computer, and God forbid there is a fire or there is a break-in, a thief who steals your computer is quite likely to pick up the drive next to it as well. So with it goes your data and the backup in one fell swoop. Similarly, fire, flood, whatever, pestilence, any of these problems can lose your backup if you haven't got one that's off-site as well. And in terms of the frequency of backup, think about how much data you're prepared to lose. If you only do your backup once a year, that means you're willing to lose up to a year's data. If the answer to the question how much data am I willing to lose is one day, then you have to back up daily. And that's not, you can automate that. Mac users are lucky, they have automated systems that can backup automatically. PC users, Windows does have backup software built into it, and it's adequate. It's not the most sophisticated backup software, but you know what? Most people aren't going to spend the money on that, or at least in the beginning, they're going to use the built-in software. And then if they discover they want to do something more sophisticated, then they'll pay for something like, Acronis or one of the other paid-for products.
Brilliant. Excellent. I'm scared of my number of backups and actually where my backups are. That's another problem that it's definitely a sort of like a first world problem, isn't it? How many backups do I have and where are they? Before the news, we've got a minute and a half before the news. Let's see if we can fit in Dan. Dan, what's your problem? You're in Oxfordshire. Very good morning to you. Very quickly, what's your problem?
Well, it's a bit of a lengthy one, really, I suspect, which is going to be rather tricky to unfold in that time.
Well, do you want us to come back to you in a minute? Can you wait until we've got the sport out of the way?
I'd be happy to,
fantastic.
Certainly.
Right, in that case, you stay there with that. And I'll tell you that I've had an email from Neil, who says, my HP laptop works fine, but it won't connect to a website, any website at all. It says the signal strength is excellent, but downloading, it just says waiting to connect to the site. It never actually connects to a site. What can be the matter?
Okay, Neil, I would normally ask you a number of questions, like was this working fine yesterday, as it were, and what changed? Are you aware of any changes? If it's a new laptop, it may be, for example, that you have a firewall running on the computer itself or in your router that may be blocking access to websites. It may be a piece of security software that's got a firewall in it that just doesn't like the look of it, and the port that the data is coming through is suspicious, and therefore it stops it. What I would do is just do a little bit of experimentation to try and identify where the problem is. So, for example, install, if you don't already have, a second browser on your machine. And by the way, that's good advice for anyone. Always have more than one browser on your computer, because if you ever have a problem with one browser, you're probably going to need to download a fix to it in some way, shape or form, which you won't be able to do if the only browser you've got isn't working. So you can install a browser, even if your machine hasn't got internet access. You can do a download of a browser off another machine and plug it in via USB and install it that way. So I would install the second browser or fire up a second browser if it's already there, and I would see if the other browser can access those websites. I would also fire up another program that uses the internet, such as an email program, and I don't mean web-based email, but if you've got, for example, Outlook on your machine or another software that can access the internet, let's see if the internet is actually accessible by that machine at all, or if it's a problem with the internet. So we can start to work out, is the problem with the browser? Is the problem with the internet service? Will that machine, for example, access the internet in a different location? If you take it to a coffee shop, for example, can you log on to their Wi-Fi? I wouldn't recommend doing that for anything useful. Public Wi-Fi is generally not secure. But just as an experiment, you know, you could take it to a friend or relative's house and try it out. So is the problem specific to your location? Is it specific to the application? Try and work that out. And is it specific to the browser? Beyond that, we can then start to look at it. If it's working, for example, with another browser, then you know that the problem is with the setup of that specific browser. And one way of doing that, and this is almost like our switch it off and switch it on again, is uninstall it and reinstall it and see if it installs with more suitable settings. It might be that you've tweaked a setting on it that you're not aware of. If nothing at your site can access the internet, then you could start by speaking to your internet service provider and finding out if there is a problem with the internet. And the other thing to do at your address is to work out, is it only a problem via the Wi-Fi? If I plug my computer into the router using an Ethernet cable, will it then work? If it works in that instance, then you know the problem is something to do with the setup of the Wi-Fi. So you need to do these little tests to work out where the problem is. I wouldn't just run and call your internet service provider or BT or what have you, because they may not help you, or they, if they send an engineer and it's not their fault, they will charge you.
I love that way that you go through a problem and break it down and take it to pieces and analyse it. It's absolutely brilliant. Dan phoned us quite a long time ago, and he's still there on the phone now. Dan, we were just about to start talking to you about your problem, but it was a complicated one, and I've just looked at a brief summary that went on for about three pages on my computer screen trying to work out what on earth we can do to help you. Go through the problem and Fevzi will sort it.
Okay. Well, thank you, Nick, and hello, Fevzi. The problem really starts with the fact that I bought a Mac in the back end of 2013, which was running on the operating system Lion, which is 10.7.5. And very soon after I'd acquired the machine, it upgraded, by which time I'd already bought a load of music production software, some of which was superseded by the newer models and was then incompatible with the operating system upgrade. So I realized that the money that had been invested was potentially lost, unless, of course, I just held on to the existing operating system, which is what I chose to do. I'm running Logic Pro 9, and I was running along with that quite happily until it got to a stage where the system had upgraded several times, and I was quite happily staying with the stuff which I bought right at the outset, but of course was then becoming limited in what I was able to buy. I then realized, as I didn't use this this iMac for anything else other than the music stuff, that it might be wise to back up the files, although I didn't have an awful lot on there. It was just a case that I'd got, you know, substantial amount of software. So I decided to use the inbuilt facility of the Apple Time Machine to back up, and I bought myself a hard drive. Now, the problem is the operating system has upgraded several times since then, and I realized that the only way for me to go forward was to back it up and then upgrade the system, accept the losses of the earlier stuff, and buy some new technology and move along. The problem is that when I got myself a hard drive to try and work it alongside the Time Machine device, it wouldn't work. It just keeps refusing to back up. And having spoken to Apple support, what it comes down to basically is that the hard drive which I have requires a later operating system to enable me to back up, which of course I can't do because I can't upgrade the operating system. So I'm now in a beautiful catch-22 with no easy way forward with this, but I'm trying to ensure that I progress in some way by firstly solving the solution of a backup, and then, you know, upgrading the operating system and accepting the losses of my earlier technology. But what I mustn't do is lose any of the music projects which I have on file And just to add to the mire, the music technology itself has also been upgraded. So we're now onto Logic Pro X, which is incompatible with the earlier system in its newest form. So I can't just simply upgrade that. So I've got a right old bit of a pig's ear here, and I've got to try and unravel the best way forward. What can you suggest?
Well, it's a tricky one, Dan, and thanks for laying that out so beautifully. I mean, that's quite complex, but I think I actually understood most of it. So thank you for that. So the first thing I'd say to you is studio users, recording artists or people who use audio software, often get to the point where everything is working well, the machine is dedicated to that function, and they actually try not to ever upgrade it, okay? And they will even keep that machine offline and just treat it as if it was, you know, a drum machine or something like that. In other words, you know, you don't have to go in and sort of flash the software every 5 minutes. If it works, take it offline. If it's a dedicated machine, doesn't have to be used for email and surfing and what have you, then, you know, you can continue to run the old version. If your machine, Dan, is capable of running a more modern operating system, just so that I'm clear on one thing, are you, as things stand, able to make backups but not retrieve them? Is that the situation?
No, I'm not able to make a backup at all. And when I spoke to Apple support, they suggested that a potential solution which would help me forward would be to try to get a legacy update to Mavericks.
Yeah.
I mean, I've no idea how I source that, because I know that Apple don't provide that now, because it's long gone. But it is one of these things where the whole thing, I can work with it as it is, and it would seem to me that maybe the whole idea would be best left just to go out and buy a new laptop, say, to work alongside it on the modern systems, which would be out of it. But at the moment, it's not the sort of money I have to be able to, you know, to buy it.
No. Okay. So I think the thing is, before we start doing anything else, we do need to get a backup of everything as it is now, because the more we tinker, the more the chance that we mess things up. And, you know, we need to be able to roll back to a backup. Your machine can't create a backup of its data at the moment, but that doesn't mean that you couldn't, for example, borrow or hire another Mac, access your existing Mac in target disk mode, which is whereby the external Mac appears to be just an external drive. It could be any sort of data on there, and use the second Mac to back up all the data on the first onto an external drive. Okay, I know that that's a bit round the houses, but what that means is that you can do a complete backup. You're going to be able to reinstate it at that point, but if you need to, you'll be able to again using a second machine. Once you've done that, once you've got everything backed up and backed up more than once, and you've even done a test restore onto another device and made sure that the backup is sound, then what you could do is upgrade your machine to the latest version of the operating system that it will run. Install Parallels, and we mentioned it before. So Parallels is one of these pieces of virtual machine software, but it runs really nicely. And then inside a virtual machine, when running in Parallels, create an older version of the operating system again. So you could create Lion or Mountain Lion, for example, the most current version where it would still work. And then you can use that to reinstate the data from the backup when running the virtual machine. And the really nice thing about using something like Parallels is that although it runs virtual machines, it gives you the ability to transfer data between them on the same machine. And it's a trick that, for example, Windows users use on a Mac, where, for example, you can run Windows in a virtual machine on a Mac, but still take advantage of the gestures and some of the other functionality. In fact, you know, I've seen some really clever things being done with Parallels, and that's why I'm suggesting that as opposed to just any other virtual machine, because you've got things like VMware and so forth that you could choose. But that would be my approach. Step one, back up everything, even if it means using a second machine, which you can borrow or hire. Obviously, don't back up onto the second machine, because you're going to have to give that back up onto an external drive, possibly the drive that you already have or another one. Once you've done that and you know that your data is safe, then do back up to the latest version, because of the operating system, that it will run. Once you've done that, install Parallels. It is a paid for program, but it will pay for itself many times, in a short time. then create a virtual machine using Lion, Mountain Lion, or as I say, the most current version that will still support what you're trying to do. And then you can copy the data across from there if you need to. And then if you still need to run Logic 9 as opposed to Logic 10, then you can still run it inside that virtual machine. And the other thing to say is, of course, eventually when you do get a newer machine, so you said yours is 2013. So it's,
I purchased at the back end of 2013, but it was actually running Lion at the time. And as I say, the upgrade followed about literally a month and a half, 2 months later.
Yeah, isn't it the way? Well, soon, at some point soon, you'll need to use that as a dedicated machine anyway, because it will stop accepting current updates. And even if it does to the operating system, even if it does, it will probably run too slowly. Did you say it was an iMac?
It was the top of the range, top spec that I bought at the time.
Yeah, and how much RAM has it got in it?
12.
So that's going to run your virtual machines in a very healthy way. And that's often the issue with running virtual machines, is that you need, a shed load of RAM memory in there, so that not only the host operating system has got enough memory to run speedily, but so is the virtual machine.
Yes, it came with 4, and I upgraded it. I added a further 8 a few months ago. Yeah.
Do you know what generation processor you have in there?
I can't remember off the top of my head.
Is it a dual core or a quad core?
I think it's quad core actually.
Again, you see, that machine, even given its age, despite its age, it's a perfect platform for running virtual machines on.
Yeah.
So you'll be able to run current or near current operating system software and Logic 10 and everything else, and you'll still be able to run the other stuff in virtual machines. And as I say, with Parallels, it has some very nice tricks for being able to have your cake and eating it, as it were, in terms of the data and the cooperation between the two. Normally, if you sort of dual booting a machine, so sometimes you can set up a computer, be it a Mac or a PC, such that as it starts up, you choose which operating system to run. So Apple give you something called Bootcamp, where you can install Windows and then on a Mac, and then choose whether you want it to be a Windows PC or a Mac as you start it up. But once you've made that decision is made until the machine is shut down and restarted. But with something like Parallels, you can actually run both at the same time and sift data between the two.
I've just had a look, actually, Dan, at to see what your computer will actually run, and there's a new operating system coming out from Apple in, I don't know, whenever they decide to open it and release it. It's saying that all the models of your computer from 2009 will run it. So you have got some life in there yet, as long as you can get it up to there in the meantime and do that.
Yeah,
so.
But the key is
the thing, it's just ensuring that I don't lose what's important in the interim. Whilst, I got to a stage where I felt like I was just about to bash my head against a brick wall, and I thought, well, I might as well just upgrade it and see what happens. But unfortunately, some of the data on there, it just can't be lost.
No, and that's why I'm saying to you, even if it means hiring a machine for a day, which obviously would be extreme, but if you have a friend or colleague that's got a Mac that will, allow you to use it for this purpose, you promise them you're not going to put any data on their machine. All you're going to do is use it to back up your machine. That's really the key, because as we fiddle, things can and will go wrong, and things can be lost, and you can dig yourself deeper and deeper as you try and fix it, and before you know it, the data's irrecoverable. But if you've got multiple backups of different types in different locations, then go ahead.
Well, very grateful. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
You're
Dan,
welcome.
Thanks very much indeed for phoning. We're going to go straight to another call now, because Edward's been waiting for a bit. Edward, what's your problem?
Hello. I don't have a computer or anything like that. I'm doing this for my nephew. He has a Medion, a Koya. It's about 6 years old. It was top of the range at the time. Mm-hmm. And the only thing he's had done was, it was Windows 7, and he got it upgraded to Windows 8. And over the past year, Febs, he's been saying, wait longer before you change up to the Windows 10.
Yeah.
Now, my query is that in the past 7 to 10 days, on a couple of commercial stations, they've been advertising a Fix Me stick, thick me stick.
Yes, I've heard that.
So, as I say, I know nothing about these things at all, but it went on to list loads and loads of sort of antivirus and anti-this and anti-the other. And so I'm wondering whether or not Febsy's had a chance to suss this out, whether it's good or bad, and whether or not it would affect any antivirus stuff that my nephew already has on his computer. It's a desktop.
Edward, for someone who doesn't own a computer, you've asked some very smart questions, I have to say.
Thank you very much.
No, you're welcome. So, I haven't tried a Fix Me Stick, but I did when I was driving my car. I had the radio on. I happened to hear an advert for it myself. I assume it's a USB drive. That's to say, one of these little thumb drives that slots into the side of a computer, and it will have on it some form of security software. I assume it's software that will run itself as soon as it's plugged in. I personally I don't have any specific knowledge about this device, and therefore I can't speak about it in particular. But in general terms, I wouldn't like to put something like that onto my PC unless I really knew what was on it. And what it was doing. So my preferred approach would be to use a free trial of a recognized security software. So, for example, you could go to the Symantec website and download a fully featured version of Norton Security. It will run for a month, at which time you can either go and install another free software or pay and have, instead of have 12 months, have 13 months because you've had the 1 month free. I would do that. Now, you've mentioned the fact that there may be other security software on there. Some sorts of security software can coexist, but antivirus programs should not have, you shouldn't have more than one of them installed on a machine at the same time. And the reason for that is that when an antivirus program is protecting you, it's running in the background, and every time you go to access a file, you're about to open a Word file or an email or whatever, it gets in and says, it's like a food taster for the king, it gets in between and says, stand back, I'm going to check it first. And then, oh yeah, I think it's fine, it hands it over. Now, that doesn't work very well if the king has two food tasters, because they're fighting over the same piece of food and who's going to taste it, and that can cause terrible problems in terms of the stability and speed of that computer. So you need to determine what security software is being run already. If there is decent software on there and it's being kept up to date, then what you need to do is what's called a full system scan. And for a Windows machine, the best way of doing that is in something called safe mode, which is a diagnostic mode of Windows. It's basically Windows in its most basic form without all the bells and whistles that normally run in the background. It starts up on a machine. You normally get into it by tapping the F8 key, the function 8 key, as you're starting up the computer. Every 1 or 2 seconds, just tap F8 until it starts up in what looks like a Fisher-Price version of Windows, because it's just big and bulbous and, you know, you think something terrible's happened. So, oh goodness. Okay. So, was it something I said?
Voices.
Yeah. I'm glad you heard that. I was beginning to worry.
Sorry, that was my clock.
Not at all. Do you know
the clock?
Do you know what, Edward? The trouble I have to go to before this program to try and make sure I've switched off every last gadget in this place, and it's not. I'm still not confident. I always sit slightly nervously to think something's going to wake up. You know, as long as it's not the listener, that's fine.
Paul, my producer's just asked a really pertinent question here. Why did your clock go off at 2:54 and 35 seconds?
It's about 5-6 minutes fast. It goes off every hour.
Because you need some warning, don't you? That's
quite... I lose track of time, so that's the nearest thing I'd think of.
Okay, so, all right, so let's try and go back, because I've thrown lots of advice at you. Okay, so I'm guessing that the reason why you're asking these questions is because the machine has slowed down.
The reason I'm asking is my nephew hasn't said that he's got a problem with what he's got. It's just that his birthday is coming up, and okay. I sort of thought, oh, this Fix Me Stick might be make a nice present if it didn't affect what he's got and if it improved what he's got.
I can't speak to any specific product that I haven't tried. You know, it could be the best thing that's ever, you know, been created. But My general feeling is if I don't know what it's running and I can't go and research and find reviews on it and make sure that it's all fine, and you may be able to do that. You know, security software is something that is, it's a very sort of personal thing. It's very hard to buy for somebody else. So if he hasn't said he's got a problem, you may speak to him about how his machine's running. You know, is it running well? Is there anything he wants for his machine? You know, you could just have a...
Best thing that I can do is just wait until you eventually review it.
Well, yeah, you could do, but when's his birthday?
The 3rd, 4th of September.
So no pressure then?
No.
I don't know that I would review it before then. I tell you what, I tell you what we can do. Contact me via Twitter at Gadget Detective, and I will do some digging into what it is, because I'm also curious now, because I just heard the advert on the radio like you. My general inkling is go for one of the tried and trusted solutions like, you know, Norton or Kaspersky or ESET if you wanted to get security software, because that, you know, that's the best. This one, we don't really know what it's running, and, you know, unless it's a product from one of these known stables, my inclination would be, you know, even without having tested it, to go for what I know, because, you know, security software isn't the right place to be innovative. You know,
On the Norton, would that still be the one that you spoke of before, 360? And if it was the Symantec, which one would that be that you'd recommend?
So Norton is a brand of Symantec.
Don't
apologize. I'm not sure that they still do a product called Norton 360. They also had something called Norton Internet Security, but I believe it's just called Norton Security now. But as I say, the joy of that is that you can just download it for free and it's fully functional for a whole month. And at the end of the month, if you decide you want to you know, pay for a year, then you don't have to reinstall the software, and you get 12 months from that time. So in other words, you get 13 months coverage in all. One thing I would say to you about antivirus and security software in general is be careful what you pay for it. I believe that security software is worth paying for. I believe that you can get tangible benefits from paid security software as opposed to free. But having said that, I don't believe in paying more for it than I have to. And with Norton and with the others, often on renewal, you know, you might have it there for a year and then it says, oh, you'd like to renew £40. No, I don't think so. I can probably do that for 10, 15 or at most £20 if I shop around. So don't just automatically renew software, or at the end of a trial period, don't just automatically accept the price that they give you. It may be that you buy a disc from somewhere and it works out much cheaper. I managed to get a version of Norton for, I forget exactly, but I think it was between £5 and £10. And it was a fully featured version of Norton. And again, you know, even when you talk about Norton software or other software, it's not all the same. Some of them allow you multiple licenses. So some of them can say you can install it on 5 machines at once, you know, and it's legal to run on 5 machines at once. Others will say it will run for 3 years or 2 years. So, you know, look around for bargains. You know, once you've decided what you want, look for a good deal. But the most important thing is to choose the best software in the first instance. Don't just go for something because it's free or because it's cheap. But I would speak to your relative before going and buying that solution or any other solution.
Brilliant, Edward. Thanks so much for your call. We're going to move on, Fevzi, to your reviews. This week, one is an app and one is a gadget. Off you go.
Okay, so the first is the app. It's called LumaFusion. That's L-U-M-A, Fusion, all one word. And it's an app that runs on Apple hardware, specifically iPads and iPhones. It's what's called a universal app, so you buy it once and it will run on all of those devices. You don't need to buy a separate one for each. It's a video editing application, but it's hard to explain this, but every now and then you encounter a piece of software that just moves the story along in terms of what our machines are and what we can do with them. And Apple has been banging on for a very long time about how the iPad Pro is a replacement for your full computer. And that's definitely the direction of travel, and we will see more of that with the new launch of iOS 11 in September. But there are still many, many things are best done on a desktop machine or on a full-blown laptop running a grown-up operating system like Windows or Mac OS. And to a large extent, you know, iOS has been a novelty. It's been, you know, oh, it's good considering its platform. This piece of software, LumaFusion, is amazing in that it is sufficiently fully featured for even people who do video editing professionally or take their video editing very seriously and do anything other than non-trivial editing. A lot of people have actually said, you know what, I'm going to stop using, for the most part, Final Cut Pro or Premiere Pro, which are software applications that either cost hundreds of pounds or for which you can pay a subscription for. This particular app, although it's expensive for an iOS app, is £19.99, but that's a one-off purchase. It's not a subscription. There are no in-app purchases for it. It's just a fully featured, highly functional video editor, and really almost no compromises. And the amazing thing is that they've managed to create this thing in such a way that it will actually run on an iPhone. You know, you can actually do proper 4K 60 frames per second video editing on an iPhone. And I'm not saying it's, you know, a completely ideal experience, but it's doable, which means that you can start your editing on there. You can then go onto an iPad or even, you know, in time export that onto another program as well. So it's not something that's for everyone, because, you know, there is iMovie, which is an Apple product, which is much more basic, but is free. But iMovie doesn't give you a true multi-track editing experience. It doesn't give you full support for PAL, which is this 25 frames per second standard that we use here. It doesn't give you, as LumaFusion does, a sort of full audio mixer. It doesn't allow you to do lossless exporting. So when you've finished everything and you want to squirt it out onto another device, iMovie insists on compressing the hell out of it and ruining all your work. For simple, you know, non-serious bits, you know, iMovie is fine. And that's probably not a bad place to start, because when you start with iMovie, you really appreciate the additional quality and features of LumaFusion. And LumaFusion also has advanced title creation tools built in. It makes full use of the touch interface. So, for example, once you've dropped in a little piece of video and it's sitting in a window, you can just put two fingers on that frame and turn it round. You can twist the video around and zoom in or zoom out on it, and the rest of it will run in that orientation and with that amount of zooming. I mean, it's hard to overstate, you know, if you are at all interested in video editing, and I know you actually know a lot more about this application than I do, so I'm going to let you in a moment.
It's really funny, though, that you say it, because what I'm keen to know is what you think of the learning experience of it, of how easy it is to grasp, because there are in Android phones and in Apple phones as well, in the iOS, there are learning curves when you pick something up.
Yeah.
How did you find the learning curve of this?
I found that it wasn't completely intuitive. You know, I'm used to, you know, I review a lot of apps of various sorts, and I usually don't read much about them. I just go in and start playing. And I found I could get a certain way into it with that approach, but there were specific things that I wanted to do that were not, you know, obvious how to do. That's not a big criticism of the software, because of the capabilities. It would be, I think, very nearly impossible to make it a completely intuitive app, given the range of capabilities it has and the size of the screen and the type of interface you're working with. So there are always going to be limitations, but as I've said, there are also advantages to that. There's the portability, there's the touch screen, there's the swipes, the gestures and so forth that, you know, you don't get on desktop software. But yes, I think, you know, you get a certain way and you think, okay, how do I get an audio track in? How do I drop it in? How do I, you know, because all software works slightly differently.
Is it for people who've got some little clips of their kids and they want to put them all together and finish them off as a finished piece that they'll send to grandparents or whatever? Or is it for more professional type of people in terms of what they want to do with the thing in the end, the video in the end?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, you know, if you are a professional type of person, you won't want to be using iMovie or any of the other products on that platform. This is the one that you will choose. The way I would look at it is, I always advise, you know, well, almost always, except with security software, is start with the free stuff. If it's already on your machine, start using it. Understand the principles of video editing, you know, and then as you start to hit its limitations, when you don't like the fact that it's compressing, you know, the file and losing the quality as you export it onto another device, at that point, then you know, then upgrade to this. The basic stuff you can do with iMovie, and iMovie has got a much shallower learning curve to it. There's no doubt, because there's less to learn, frankly, and therefore the curve will in and of itself be shallower if the software is decent. But frankly, if I were Apple now, I'd be looking at buying up LumaFusion and branding it as an Apple product because it's that good. And they kind of put Apple to shame because Apple used to make the sort of the gold standard software in every field for its machines, and now that's no longer the case. It's great that third party's done it, but you know, Apple should have a kick for not doing it themselves. But I would say for the basic stuff, for the really basic stuff, use iMovie. And if you're happy to do it, don't pay that. Even Astounding Value, though, £19.99 is, why pay it if you're happy with what you've got? But a lot of people, it depends, some people will just do the basics and only ever do it. Other people will start, you know, advancing and want to just be a bit more creative with it.
And one of the worst things that can happen, and it's happened to me so many times over the years, is that you compress, you finish doing some editing on some pictures of the kids when they were little babies, and then you compress it down and in using whatever you had to hand at the time, and you go back to look at that a few years later, and the quality of it is appalling, because it's just so terrible. So being able to export, to save off the finished file in the same quality as it was originally is a big thing, isn't it?
It really is, and you, I mean, you've hit the nail on the head, Nick, because even if you're happy with all the features, if what you're editing is important and it's going to be important in the years to come, then it's kind of incumbent upon you to try and preserve that in the best quality that you can. And iMovie, great though it is, an excellent value for money because it's free, you know, does have that limitation that when you export it, that's to say you squirt out the finished product from that machine into a different format, it compresses it, and it compresses it in what's called lossy compression. That's to say it throws away a whole bunch of the data. It is a bit like getting rid of your CD collection and just using MP3 versions of it going forward. Yes, you know, it's fine, but I wouldn't want to use those as you know, the copies of that music I had for all time. So if a piece of software is able to preserve the quality of my CDs, then that's what I would like. So I think at $19.99, if you're at all interested in this sort of thing, you know, just buy it and play with it. You won't regret it. I am of an age where I remember when I was taught video editing, we used to go into what was called a three-machine editing suite. And it was a large room with a big table with three large clunking video recorders, one that would feed in from one source, one that would feed in from another source, and a third machine that would allow the edited version to reside upon it, and a big edit desk that took up the size of a whole desk. And it was a big deal, and it was tens of thousands of pounds even in those days of equipment. And now I do much better, as I say, 60 frames a second, high definition video on my phone at the bus stop.
It is amazing. I'll admit that I know this program because I've used it for pieces here on Five Live and on television as well. And as you say, standing at the bus stop, I was sitting on the banks of the River Nile in South Sudan, editing away on a tablet there using this piece of software. And the finished piece, once it finally, after about 7 hours of uploading the file over the internet, was on breakfast television. So, you know, that's the type of thing that you can do. There are alternatives as well. If you, for Apples as well as Android phones, because Luma isn't available for Android, there's one called KineMaster or KineMaster, whichever way you pronounce it, which is probably the market leader in that one. Again, the problem there is that it goes with a subscription model rather than a one-off payment, which is difficult for people.